Molly Ringwald has to choose between a jerk and another jerk because it's the prom and she's good at dresses. It's the 1980s version of romance or something. And the theme song plays 12 times in Pretty in Pink, which was the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
Movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Hi there, I'm Sean Collier. This is the number one movie in America. Valentine's edition, I guess. This is our pre-Valentine's episode, and it's famous romance, Pretty in Pink.
Well, look at that.
Appropriate. Huh. Which also means Sean's birthday edition, right?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Your birthday is Valentine's Day.
It is.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right.
And don't you also have a roundabout times birthday, Camila?
The 25th of February.
It's nice because last time we could do things and celebrate and see our loved ones.
I know.
This year, not so much. But
actually, I think that's
I didn't introduce either of these two non-masked robbers. It's Camila Adams.
Hey. I froze.
and Robin Hitchcock.
Hi there.
Robin, who is extensively pretty in pink this afternoon. Camila, kind of a maroon.
Yeah, it's more of a puce, I guess, is what we're working with here.
Yeah, I have two pink shirts. And this is one of them.
I was never really big on wearing pink, like for the longest time.
Me either.
Like,
it's like I don't have anything wrong with the color. It's just not, it doesn't appeal to me the same way other things do.
Yeah, but you know, it's fine. And it's also not something that I always would be like, no, like orange. I refuse to wear orange.
See, I love orange.
It's a nice visual change of pace in that we just talked about the town, Taken, Solo, the Bone Collector, National Treasure. I don't think we've seen the color pink in 2 months, so including on the town, which landed in a respectable 20th place overall with our 72 score. That's fairly high. It won it won a tiebreaker victory over Ant-Man. Ant-Man had the same score, 72. Tiebreaker is the highest individual score. That was my 74 for the town. So a top 20 finish, sure. Yes.
Yeah, that seems right. I can accept that.
Seven, still in seventh. But on to much more new wave things. Where are we all coming from with John Hughes and the Brat Pack and teenage feelings from 30 years ago?
Well,
35 years ago.
Camila first, right, she was the most
I was alive.
Aware and alive,
right?
As we like to say.
Exactly. So I was 10 when this movie came out. So clearly it wasn't necessarily on my radar, but I think like of the John Hughes collection, Breakfast Club is always number one. And I don't recall, is Ferris Bueller, is that a John Hughes movie?
It is.
Okay, and Ferris Bueller was always like right there. I may have seen Pretty in Pink in bits and pieces when I was too young to care or understand what was really happening when it was like on TV or something like that. But I've never sat and purposefully watched it. It was interesting to go back into this 80s mindset and just kind of see like what was acceptable for women to accept.
It was acceptable in the 80s.
Right, exactly. This is totally fine. She should be grateful. So, that's where I am.
Well, I liked, you know, I probably saw The Breakfast Club when I was 16 and had the reaction you're supposed to, like, oh, good, I'm allowed to have feelings.
This
movie affirmed that that's a possibility for me. And I like John Hughes a lot. But not in this mode. I mean, both Vacation and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles are in my top 10 favorite movies. Until the past year, this is the first time I've seen Pretty in Pink. I saw Weird Science and 16 Candles at drive-ins last summer. And I'll save it for later in the pod, but this has not shaken my affinity for John Hughes writing about grown-ups. That's that's the way to go for him, I think. And certainly not children. I mean, Home Alone was good, but after that, got hairy for a good the rest of his life. Robin?
So it's complicated, and I feel like I could just talk for an hour, but the short version is that this was probably my favorite of the John Hughes Brat Pack movies, not including Ferris Bueller, which always feels a little separate.
Right.
But it like... does. We've talked before about my controversial bad take on The Breakfast Club, which is I don't like it. We've talked before about how 16 Candles is too problematic to really enjoy. But I love this movie. I identified with Andy as an outcast kind of kid and as a daddy's girl. And when I was a little girl, you know, you want the rich boy to notice you and to start to like you. And so I liked the stupid fairy tale that this tells. And then I had my, you know, teenage or preteen years where I was on team, well, she should have ended up with Ducky. And then I became a young adult and realized that Ducky is a psycho.
Yes.
And I will continue to editorialize in my 60-second plot summary if we want to transition into that.
What great timing. Yes. Because now, with a 60-second plot description of Pretty in Pink, here's Robin Hitchcock. And go.
Molly Ringwald plays Andy, a quirky girl from the wrong side of the tracks in that part of Illinois that John Hughes writes about. There are three archetypes of nightmare men who are all interested in Andy. There's clueless rich boy Blaine, who doesn't care about her at all and has no interest in knowing her, but thinks she's pretty and controllable. Charming weirdo Ducky, who thinks he's entitled to her because he is, in fact, authentic. And sociopath rich boy James Spader, who, let's be real, does not actually want Andy. He wants Blaine, and he hates Andy for standing in the way of that. Harry Dean Stanton is her depressed dad, and Andy Potts is her boss at the record store. They're both amazing. Ducky lip syncs to Otis Redding, also amazing. Andy mangles a classic A-line swing dress into a sartorial atrocity and goes to prom stag. Ducky nobly allows her to date the person she's actually attracted to, but oh yeah, he also sucks. This movie is extremely depressing, and men are the worst.
That's
yeah.
30 seconds of plot, 15 seconds of opinion. It's all packaged in a mere 45 seconds. Well nice. Done.
I feel like this script was written on Post-it notes.
I remember when I was getting a little bit older, like, when I was probably like 16 or so and I saw this movie, before I realized that Ducky was a psycho. But when I was getting more closer to adulthood, I was like, this is messy.
Yes.
I was like, this is not a very well put together movie. Right.
Well, the theme of my notes is, what is this about? Is this about the class issue? Is this about the love triangle? And then by like an hour in, I'm like, okay, it's kind of about both of those things, but forgot to establish that for a good half hour or 40 minutes. It takes right. a long time before Pretty in Pink decides what its subject is.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, so much. I haven't watched this movie in probably 15 years. And so much of my reaction to it this time around was like, oh, well, Lady Bird did this, but right. Mm. You know, like the class issues where everybody's actually well off. Like, that is a weird story to tell, right? Like, when she's like, I can't let you see my house.
Right.
And it's like a nice suburban home with a lawn.
Yeah.
I was like, what? But then I thought about when I was in high school and my family was wealthy, but the other families were wealthier. And it messed with you as a kid. And so, like, it makes sense for her to have this kind of baggage, but it doesn't have any adult perspective on that baggage. And I feel like maybe it being set contemporaneously is part of the problem there. Like, they really should have pulled the Lady Bird Happy Days Wonder Years thing, put this movie 20 years in the past so that the adult perspective could be like, you are fine. You're fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like... It didn't seem like it. Her family's lack of money really kept her from anything, really. Like, she still right. had her little part-time job, which she enjoyed. It was like, she worked at a record store. She had friends. Right, yeah, she had friends, and they had a place to hang out, and they were actually better people than the Richies, who they, as they call them. Like, her dad loves her and adores her. Like, just... And she had a scholarship, like, to right. go to college. So it wasn't like that was a problem, that she was going to have to stick around and scrape up some money to go to college. Like,
and everyone loves her.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. She's not a bad literally, person. She gets
good. Every man in this movie's after her.
Right. And she gets good grades. She has her own life. Like, she has a good she has pretty decent self-esteem as to where, like, she's making her own clothes and, like, wearing them to school. Like, shit. I mean, some of that shit should never have left her house. But
yes.
But yeah, so
she's the only person in this entire town not arbitrarily hated by mostly everybody else. Every teen in this movie hates every other person in this movie, except some of them don't hate Andy.
Right.
Like, why is there so much aggression in the fictional Illinois town?
I mean,
this time around,
the answer is repressed homosexuality. Let's be real.
Let's forward this theory before we get to the facts, because this is momentous.
So a couple things. First of all, I do think it is very interesting. Like, I know that a lot of gay kids, I'm straight, but a lot of gay kids watching this movie, I know, will like identify with Ducky as like, oh, you're quirky and weird. And this is what I always felt like. Right. And I can't remember who it is, but I remember one of my gay friends talking to me at some point about they were the same way, that they would fixate on women who, like, if only you would love me, then I wouldn't be gay anymore.
Right.
Right. And then my whole life would be fixed. So John Cryer in the past talked about, like, well, okay, like, I don't want to take away what you think about it, but that's not what this character is. And, like, there should be a place in pop culture for, like, weirdo heterosexual boys, right?
There is. It's jail.
And also, there's this exciting thing called bisexuality.
Right.
Check it out. So, that aside, I do not understand a reading of this where James Spader is not in love with Blaine.
Yeah, I don't. That doesn't make any sense to me, because literally Blaine dating Andy has no bearing on his life whatsoever.
Right.
Like, other than unless he wants to be with him. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. And as far as Ducky's concerned, I feel like he probably got a lot of motherfuckers in trouble in the 80s who wanted to, like, you know, because he's a stalker on, like, the umpteenth level. Oh, geez. Like, he is.
Not just in the 80s, like, every boy since then.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's not like Ducky invented being a nice guy or stalking women, but the normalization of Ducky.
Yes, exactly. The point that it's like, yeah. Oh, he's harmless, you know, oh, it's just Ducky. Oh, the whole, you know, I'm going to, what's your address? I want to put you on my route. Like, no.
Where he says, what I do is drive past your house. Yeah, this is the official fuck a duck segment of the podcast, because the only thing I knew about this movie beforehand, other than I knew that Harry Dean Stanton was supposed to be great, which he is, it should have just been him and Molly Ringwald being nice to each other while the hits of the 80s played for the whole thing. That would have been fine. The only other thing I knew about it was that people are like, oh, she should have ended up with Ducky. And I'm watching the movie and it's like, the fuck she should? That speech that he gives that's like, you won't be able to respect yourself anymore,
right,
if you do this. It's like, fuck you and never talk to me again.
Right.
Like,
right?
The way he cordons her life off as his is gross.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is not like, oh, that was a little stalkerish. It's not like every breath you take by the police feels a little creepy in retrospect. It's like, no, this is unhealthy and weird.
Yeah, he's very obsessive.
Every woman has had a man do this to them.
Right. When they think, like, I'm just going to wear you down. Like, it's not cute. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make you feel safe at all. And it's, yeah, it's just Ducky's just consistent. It's like he felt, and like you said, entitled to her because he was obsessed, or he was obsessed or because of the fact that he knew her the longest, because he's been hanging around forever. It's crazy.
I mean, she probably shouldn't have ended up with either of them.
No.
But if for some reason these are her only options, she made the right choice. Like,
dude, you're leaving in several months.
Right.
Like, it's okay. You don't need it. You went this long without a little boyfriend. You can go on and go off to college. Right. And have a better options.
Also, if what she wants from Blaine is some between the sheets action, like, she can get it. He doesn't actually need to have a personality or care about hers in order to get her where she needs to go sexually.
Right.
Well, at least one or two of the facts play into this directly, so let's get to that. Pretty in Pink was released February 28th of 1986, the sixth number one movie of the year. It won its opening weekend with just a hair over $6 million, and barely is a number one for that weekend. The comedy horror film House, not the Japanese one that's really good, the one with William Catt, what's his name, the greatest American hero.
Okay. I don't know.
George Wendt is in it. It's pretty good. That debuted in second with $5.9 million, so a bit of a photo finish between the two. Those two kept their spots the following weekend. Pretty in Pink won again with $4.9 million, so it is a two-week number number one. The debuting Highlander only managed 2.4 million and a seventh place finish. Pretty in Pink fell to second the following weekend to the Michael Keaton comedy Gung Ho. Stuck around for a long time without really making a ton of money. It spent 10 weeks in the top 10, $40.4 million total, 22nd overall for the year, and second among John Hughes movies. Ferris Bueller was 10th that year. So talking about the four, to me, the four key John Hughes Brat Pack movies, Pretty in Pink is second among those. Breakfast Club made $45.8 million, Pretty in Pink, $40.4 million. Weird Science made 23.8, and 16 Candles is the lowest, 23.6. He did better without the Brat Pack, as much as that's the iconic, you know, oh, 80s John Hughes, Molly Ringwald movies. The other ones made more. Ferris Bueller made a lot more. All three 80s National Lampoon's Vacations made more. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles made more. Uncle Buck made more. Generally, when he wasn't doing these, it was much more profitable. I guess the teen market wasn't as big of a thing yet?
Mm-hmm. I mean, cultural impact and box office are not necessarily the same thing.
That's true. And, you know, it's everyone and their mother went to see Ferris Bueller. That's, you know, much more of a four quadrants type movie. Yeah, it's charming. So, the original ending of Pretty in Pink, Andy gets together with Ducky. They wrote it.
Does she, though? Does she, though? My understanding is just that the original ending is she doesn't get back with Blaine. That it's just, like, the thing that we see in the movie where he's like, I'm here, I'll be your date, and then they get on the dance floor. That's different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, it is technically different. I think that in a movie this broad, whichever guy is dancing with Molly Ringwald at the end, they're together.
Is her husband.
Okay. They're married and have eight kids.
Okay.
That was filmed, and they showed it to test audiences, and test audiences didn't like it. They thought she should end up with Blaine. They had to call everyone back to refilm it. John Hughes and John Cryer were both super pissed.
I knew they had to refilm that because Andrew McCarthy's hair is so radically different at the prom as from every other scene in the movie.
Can we just do a quick thirst aside about hair? Because that haircut should come back.
His original haircut, not the prom haircut.
No, both. Or James Spader's hair is really what I'm talking about here. Like, I just want a man with mid-length blow-dried hair that I can run my fingers through while we make out. That's all I want.
Too much product now, you know? Mine included. This is sculpted, you know?
Yeah.
You can't do that. No. Thirst breaks aside, yeah, John Hughes was really mad about the new ending. Had a falling out with the director, Howard Deutsch. It was a short-lived falling out because that guy directed Some Kind of Wonderful and The Great Outdoors, but everyone named John was really pissed about it. Speaking of things that might have saved the movie a little bit, not that John Cryer's good, but Molly Ringwald didn't want John Cryer. Molly Ringwald wanted Robert Downey Jr. in the part, and yep, that would have worked.
That would have made it so much better.
Because of Back to School?
I wrote, before I found that fact, I wrote in my notes, Ducky is not charming. This is the less charismatic version of Robert Downey Jr. in Back to School.
Nice.
Those were from the same year. They were filmed concurrently.
Weren't they in
an existing trope?
But maybe was she in, like, she was in The Pickup Artist with RDJ, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know which
Robert
came
Downey
first.
Jr., he's seen as, like, Brat Pack adjacent.
Yeah.
Like, that was
their cousin.
He was part of their crew, where John Cryer wasn't. Apparently, the other part of this is no one liked John Cryer. Molly Ringwald and Andrew McCarthy didn't get along well with him. No animosity, just, like, very different personality types. They didn't gel. And I'll say you can tell.
Yeah. I would imagine Andrew McCarthy doesn't get along with a lot of people. He just seems like that type.
This is the same high school as Grease. Just thought you should know.
Cute.
And to pivot a little bit, the soundtrack to Pretty in Pink, which has since been included in Rolling Stone's 25 Greatest Soundtracks of All Time, was a big hit. The singles did better than the album in terms of charts and such. If You Leave by Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark went to number 4. The re-recorded version of Pretty in Pink by the Psychedelic Furs went to number 41. 5 songs charted in England from this soundtrack. It was re-released in 2013 on pink vinyl for Record Store Day.
Aww.
That is no less than $50 on eBay. When I saw that it was on this list of the 25 greatest soundtracks of all time, I thought, let's play a quick game. it's the return of the segment I always forget to do, Pop Quiz Hotshot. take turns. We'll let Camila go first because she was more alive. I just mean older. I just mean you're culturally aware of more of the music of the past, you know, the Rolling Stone era. You each get three guesses for anything on this list. Rolling Stone's top 25. Want to see which one of you can get more of them correct.
Of all time.
Of all time. We know the Pretty in Pink is on there. Camila, name a movie soundtrack that is also on the list.
Purple Rain.
You are correct. It is number 2 on their list. Barely. I should say Pretty in Pink is 11. Robin.
Night Fever.
You have named number 5 on the list. So you're 1-for-1 so far. Camila.
Pulp Fiction.
Good guess.
Correct. Number 7. Robin.
The Big Chill.
Ooh.
Incorrect.
Oh, man. I should have asked when they published this.
Yeah, when did they publish this?
If there were boomers involved, The Big Chill would have been on that list.
I want to say it was I think it was 2013 that this was published.
Okay. Yep. If that was published in 2003, Big Chill, 3rd on the list.
Camila can clinch the victory and go 3-for-3.
The Lost Boys.
What's your guess? Incorrect. Robin has the opportunity to tie it up.
Are there, like, movie musicals on there?
I will say not in the sense that you're asking, no.
Okay. Let's say I am blanking here. Singles, my favorite movie soundtrack. Oh.
Singles is correct.
All right. There we go.
On the nice. List. You're tied.
A player, so that you could listen to that soundtrack.
That's a good one.
You're tied. It's a shootout now. So we'll keep going. Camila.
Reality Bites.
Incorrect. Puck. Not on the list. Robin can clinch it.
I've got another boomer guess. Forrest Gump.
No. Good guess, but no. We're still tied at 2. If this kills long enough, I'll stop. But I'm entertained for now. Camila.
This is terrible. Just for his time's sake, The Godfather.
Oh, The Godfather is not on there. They are clearly not thinking about scores. Robin, if you get one, you win. If you don't, we'll end it and it's a tie.
Top Gun.
Ooh.
No, good guess, but no.
I literally just heard Take My Breath Away, and I was like, this song rules. This song truly rules.
That song is in Top Gun as much as Pretty in Pink is in Pretty in Pink. The category that would have saved you is The Beatles, as number 1 is Help, number 4 is A Hard Day's Night, number
That's 18 just fucking Madden cheating.
Street. Kind of.
What else didn't you get? The Harder They Come.
What is that?
The Harder They Come is an iconic reggae movie.
Oh, okay.
Has a lot of Jimmy Cliff and Toots and the Maytals, and that's actually number 3.
Is Buena Vista
Point Blank on there? Oh, that's a really great soundtrack. No.
Buena Vista Social Club?
No. From there, Superfly, Rushmore, This Is Spinal Tap, Oh Brother Where Art Thou, Wild Style, Train Spotting, Easy Rider, Goodfellas. Goodfellas was the closest to The Godfather. Right. The Graduate, Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh.
American Graffiti, Boogie Nights, Single. Oh, you said Singles. 24-Hour Party People, Lost in Translation. That was there. This one's kind of only 10 years old. Juice, Rock and Roll High School, and The Monkey's Head.
I would have never gotten any of those.
Yeah, that's a weird list.
It is a very weird
list.
They're
combining different things.
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink is not the same thing as Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Right.
Or A Hard Day's Night, or right. Yeah, that's an odd. But was I correct? That's not what you meant by movie musicals. You were thinking
that
of
is
like.
Not, I was thinking Grease specifically.
Right. Weird list, but Pretty in Pink, sure. So yeah, that's the sound of like why
watching this movie as a grown up in the 21st century is that sound.
Yeah.
So is it as simple, considering this is the reaction I had to this, the reaction I had last summer when I watched 16 Candles. We talked about that on the show. Robin hates Breakfast Club. Is it?
Hates a strong word.
Robin is a Breakfast Club denier.
Correct.
Is it as simple as if you got to one of these at the right age and it made you identify with something? Like with me in Breakfast Club, like somewhere between Anthony Michael Hall and Ali Sheedy's character, when I was 16, I was like, they are me. Mm. And I know what it feels like. Do you have to have that reaction to one of these movies to go, oh, I love it? And otherwise you're just like,
I kept trying to put myself in Molly's shoes I kept trying to find something to identify with. Like, I wasn't one of the wealthy kids in school, and it was also it was extra difficult because I went to a private Catholic school, so it was like the majority of the kids there had, you know, parents with money. But I still never really felt like that where she is concerned. I think my biggest issue is the fact that she takes this, like, we get pushed to the point where we think that she's standing up for herself when she corners Blaine in the hallway and, like, forces him to tell her the truth of what he really thinks. And then she just goes and goes off with him. Anyway, like, dude disrespected her greatly. And it's fucked up to think that that's like the message that was like, oh, it's okay. Like in 1986, like, you know, he was ashamed to really, like, down to his core. He's ashamed to be seen with you in public and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he let his friends push him around. And don't think like his same little insecurities aren't going to resurface later. And what you said, Robin, about, you know, if she was just trying to get her rocks off. Cool. Like I could ride with that because.
Yeah.
The activity between them, like she seems to be like the sexual aggressor between
she's
the two.
Into it.
And I'm okay. Like, sure, go on. If that's what you want to do, baby, you go ahead and do that. But if you think that this dude is going, you're going to go right off into the sunset and have this awesome relationship, it's going to be awful. It's going to be awkward in a couple weeks, let alone years.
Also, just to be clear, he's not ashamed of being seen with her. He's ashamed of his homosexual desire for James Spader. Clearly.
I didn't know James Spader was ever vaguely dreamy.
James Spader. He needs to call me.
But here's the proof.
Yeah.
The spoilers for the bingo section.
All right.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of has to be like a situation where, for me anyway, I feel like you have to like identify with somebody in this film in order to be like, right. Yeah, I can see this happening and I understand it and I love it. So, which concludes as to why I do not
identify with Andy. And like, and ultimately, like, I'm going to give this movie a good score. Part of me wants to give it an even better score than I'm going to give it. I do have genuine love for this movie in my heart, even though I also think it depicts a horror story.
Right.
and is ultimately narratively flawed. And yeah.
I'd say Annie Potts has got to be by far the best thing about this film.
Isn't she so delightful?
I love her.
And she starts dating a responsible fellow shop owner. It's nice.
Yeah, but I don't like how it sort of implies that, like, it's not the real her when she's, like, punked up for the record store. Why can't that be the real her?
Or that is the real her, and she's changing herself for
changing
this dude.
Changing for him.
That's how I read it.
She says she's like, he just lets me be me. And I'm like, well, then why don't you look like you?
Oh. That's weird.
People can contain multitudes, right?
Or maybe
people can have.
Yeah, maybe it's just like the fact of, you know, in her shop, like she can dress how she can be. It's a theatrical.
Yeah.
It's theatrics. That's what it's about.
It makes sense to me that people like Annie Potts or Ducky or like very fashionable outcasty people, like they're gonna code switch to a certain extent, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, Ducky doesn't have 15 different accessories on when he gets in bed at night, you know, like, right. Anyway, speaking of Ducky, you mentioned you don't find him charming, even when he's lip syncing to Otis Redding.
I wanted to punch him in the throat.
Oh my God. Okay, let's talk about this because Colin was like, I am mad how much I like this. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that the first time I ever heard that song was when I saw this movie.
Really?
Like that is a very like iconic scene for me of just, I adore this. So I am very curious how it plays for grown-ups.
Aside from the fact that Ducky is annoying, it also, it's weird because Molly and Annie, they don't seem jazzed about any of this.
Oh,
at
I know.
All.
They're like, please stop. And it almost feels like he does it a lot.
Right.
Like this happens regularly.
Right. So like, it's just these blank kind of stares at him. And so like the whole scene, like I think there's something, there should have been a little bit extra something, like Annie and Molly should have given us something. Because I think that makes the scene not work for me.
There are two moments I liked Ducky. One was when he was lying in bed listening to the Smiths and flipping cards in a hat, because I'm like, yes, this is who you are. And when he's running away from the fight and he jumps up and knocks down the prom banner, I'm like, that would be really satisfying in that moment. If I were running away from that fight, I would also tear down that obnoxious prom banner. Honestly, I was half looking away from the screen during the lip syncing scene because I'm like, oh yeah, ostentatious kid is being ostentatious. What? whatever.
I truly love it. I got upset when he ripped down the prom banner because I was like, they painted all of those prom court candidates' names. Painting names legibly is difficult. I used to paint signs in high school.
Yeah, just been one shot of somebody, some poor schmo just kind of walks out like, oh man, Ducky, why?
Do you know how many times it took me to correctly write out Brzezowski?
I'm interested to know like how big the student body is in this school, because they've all gone up until senior year where like half of them haven't ever met each other. Like I understand not hanging and talking and all that stuff, but to be like, oh, I'm Ducky, blah, blah, blah. You know, nice to meet you, Blaine. Or like, really? Like, and not once? Y'all never had a class together? Nothing? Never?
I mean, that would have been my high school. Like, I graduated with like 450, so that absolutely could have happened.
Well, we started up, my class, I think, started off with like 450, 500, and by the time we graduated, it was like down to 250, 300. But there's like a half, there's a couple of kids that if I were to look in the yearbook now, I wouldn't remember them. But at that time, like when I was in school, I would have absolutely known who they were, at least.
I know this is possible because at least once my mom has been like, you know, so-and-so who you went to high school with? And I'm like, sure, let's assume I do.
Is this going to matter in the story that you're telling me?
Right.
Did you both go to your prom?
I did not go to prom.
I didn't either.
High five.
Yes. Yes. With my late high school girlfriend, Alex. And
how
it was, speaking of my mother, what's that?
She died?
No, no. My girlfriend in late high school.
Oh,
like, oh my God. I think
probably cut that out.
Right, yes. No, I was right there. I was like, oh my God.
Like, I was like, you're being so weirdly casual about this shot.
For some reason, I occasionally imply someone's dead without trying to. Like, occasionally I'll do it. I was leaving a voicemail and I was trying to say, hi, my dad gave me your number. And apparently in the message I said, hi, this is Sean Collier. My dad passed on your phone number to me.
Oh my God. What is wrong with you? So Lonnie is dead, set on giving you guys a deal.
Right.
Okay, so your
the girl I dated towards the end of high school.
Yeah.
Right, that person. The big controversy is my high school did the promenade where every couple like walks across the stage and gets named. Like it's, you know,
like a debutante ball.
Yeah, like it's a debutante ball. And my mom was so psyched for that. And Alex was just like, oh, there's absolutely no way. I'm not. And I was just like, you two can have this out. Even at 18, I was like, this is not my fight and I will be stepping aside. Alex won, which is great because I didn't want to do that shit.
Nice. Adorable.
Prom was not a huge deal at my high school. Like people didn't tend to go if they didn't have a boyfriend.
Hmm.
And I definitely did not have a boyfriend because, like I said, identifying with the teen outcasts.
Yeah.
So, but married the prom king, no big deal.
Aw. Yeah, I didn't, nobody asked me. And then it was like up until like 2 weeks before prom, then it'd be like random dudes would come up to me and be like, you're not going to prom? I would have asked you. I thought for sure you had a date. Thup, 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 thup. Yeah. But I did go to an adult prom with Dan several years ago. And
I've always wanted to do that.
And I was voted prom queen. So.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
I guess
congratulations.
Colin and I did go to, we went to an 80s prom benefit one time, and we were both on the prom court at the 80s prom benefit.
Nice.
Because we dressed up.
Nice.
Because, have you met me? I'm wearing pink for a podcast recording.
Right, exactly. You're like, 80s prom, let's do this.
Yeah.
I went to an emo prom at the zoo, which is just the right combination of words to get me to go, sure.
Man, I hope that the pandemic ends and events occur.
Right.
Well, to be positive for a minute, there are things I like about this movie. I like Annie Potts. I don't care if it's insensitive. I'm giving the movie +1 for her having a gong doorbell. Harry Dean Stanton was great. I liked the what has to be the first recorded computer flirting scene.
Right?
Those computers are rather fancy for 1986.
I was impressed.
And I love Andy's car. Like, we do not address how did you get a ridiculously nice custom automobile.
Right?
Nor do we address outside that club, they pan over a two-tone checkerboard car, and it's like, I'm sorry, that car is the main character of the film now.
Exactly. Yeah. I have questions, and I would very much like it for them to be all addressed about these cars. Yeah, you're right. That car was dope.
But it has a dent in it. She's poor.
You know, and for the longest time, I guess, I don't know if they wait long or I wasn't paying attention, but it's like later on we find out what happened to her mom, that her mom just left. Her mom's not dead. And when I first saw the dent in the car and in the car, my thought went to that her mom was dead and that was the car that she died in. Like, she died in a car crash.
Now you got a movie. Now you're adding plot elements which could be revealed later and make things more interesting. But no. Can we rate it? I feel like we are delaying us saying numbers that will break the hearts of John Hughes numbers. I give it a 54, and I started below 50, and I just was like, this gets to good on the soundtrack alone. Camila?
I get 53. It started higher, then the ending happened, and I was like, oh, fuck no. And then just knocked that bitch down.
For the second time in a couple weeks, and now for a higher number, here's Robin.
68.
Okay. That Which seems like what my number would have been if I had seen this when I was 16.
Right, exactly. 20 points of that is youthful goodwill woven into my DNA.
Lands it on a 58 and a third. That means... I guess it's good, but what's the translation on that one? To the bingo card, you know, of all of the crushes that I would have thought would break this, like, seven episode, we haven't hit a crush streak, I would not have guessed James Spader.
I know.
He needs to call me. Here's the thing. When we drew this movie last week, I thought, am I going to click off Robin's crush for James Spader here? And then I was like, no, you know, these days when I see James Spader, it just, like, his current old man network procedural face is, like, superimposed on his young hot face. This is the hottest that James Spader ever is.
Wow.
So it eclipsed his old man puffy face, and I just want to hold his hand.
Hold his hair.
So you're not affected by, like, oh, but he's being such a dick in this. That is not, you are not going to be deterred.
I think it's probably the contrary. I think it probably helps.
Exactly. And then especially because I've explained away all of his dickish behavior as repressed homosexual lust, which is incredibly hot. So, yeah, I want him to take it out on me.
Well, we are certainly crossing off Robin's crush, and with gusto are we crossing it off. Yeah. Also, dog,
yes.
Did we do eating on screen?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Robin's crush is crossed off. Dog is crushed off. Could have used more of the dog in the movie. Probably could have added a few points, but nevertheless, there he was. Two squares added this week. I don't have a crush on Molly Ringwald. I mean, I love her because, you know, it's Molly Ringwald, but I would not classify this as a crush. So does that give anyone bingo?
Nope. I'm like one away.
Yeah, I'm closing in a couple directions. Note about Molly Ringwald. Colin was like, she's so good for, like, being pretty, but not, like, exceptionally pretty. And I was like, yeah, she's the girl next door. And Colin reacted to that like he had never heard that expression before. He was like, oh my god, that's the perfect way to describe her. What? Like, it, like, blew his mind. And then I was like, have you literally never heard that before? He's like, no, I've heard that before, but, like, it's so true.
Oh my god.
He's lying. He had never heard it before. That was the first. That brings us to You Can't Handle the Truth. I love Malcolm and Marie, which will be out on Netflix by the time you hear this. Came in with a dose of skepticism at another pandemic-filmed movie. Zendaya and John David Washington are the only two people in the film. No other human being is seen. The entire thing is one argument between these two people, and it's so good. Largely because they are so good, but it's beautifully shot. My Critics' Choice ballot is going to be covered with black and white movies between this and 40-year-old version. But, man, it gets so many things right about what a long argument between romantic partners feels like. And those two just absolutely sell the hell out of it. I like both of them, and this is the best I think either of them have been by a mile. I've watched a bunch of awards type movies this week, and that was, you know, the one that really, really jumped out and has to be called one of the best Netflix original movies. So, my God, watch that now.
I think it's interesting that you really loved Marriage Story, the previous Netflix couple fight movie. And
that's true.
Just pointing it
that's
out.
That's true. Am
I did feel appropriately
working things
shamed.
Out from my past? Who knows?
Like, because my first reaction to this was like, she's young.
Me too.
Like, she is young. And I don't know if you saw that she did an interview where she's like, everybody, I'm a grown up.
But still.
She was like, just because I have been playing a teenager the entire time I've been famous doesn't mean that I'm not a woman in my 20s. And I was like, okay, I feel appropriately shamed, Zendaya. I'm sorry.
But still, like, there's such a big age difference between the two of them. It just,
yeah,
it's like glaring to me. And it's almost, like, I mean, I don't know what their fight is about, but it's like, I was like, well, I can see why you guys are fighting. Like, there's like a 10, 15 years between you. You guys see things, see the world a little different, but yeah.
It is not textually inappropriate. What am I trying to say? That is relevant to their characters.
Okay.
No one is playing a different age. They are playing people who are in a relationship and are that far apart, and that causes some.
Well,
that
good.
Probably is responsible for some of their
Well, that makes
sense.
That's
good. But
yeah, really, really like it. I'm seeing. I try not to even be aware of what critical reaction is, and some people are like, "Oh, it's just one of those talk-a-thon script movies," and I'm like, well, yeah, shut up. They're allowed. Like,
right?
Some movies are just people talking. It's fine.
And when they're done well, they are amazing. Like,
it's true.
Because they're not leaning on a bunch of special effects and random shit blowing up. Like, fine. I watched Salt and Pepper, Lifetime movie.
Okay. Talk about it. How was it?
It was good. It was better than most Lifetime movies. I feel like they would have been better off doing like a limited series, like a 10 episode limited series, as opposed to trying to squeeze everything into this 2 hours with commercials. Because Salt and Pepper, like talking about like films that I'm not sure like what story they were trying to tell. Like this was it didn't know exactly what we were doing. Like, were we glossing over some of like the serious issues, like, you know, Salt's bulimia and Peppa's domestic violence situation, and also like we don't really dig deep enough into the impact that they had as female MCs on the rap world and the entertainment industry. So it's just a lot of glossing, and they could have done better than most Lifetime movies, but they deserve more. And I know they were both involved in this, and Queen Latifah was a producer and Mario Van Peebles was a director, but I guess Lifetime only gives them like, a couple days and $5,000 to make a movie.
There's only so much that his powers can accomplish on that budget.
Exactly. It's like, I did the best that I could. It's like, I'm not blaming you, Mario. I'm sure Lifetime, because I'm positive they filmed 10 films a day. So,
how does Spinderella come across?
Barely there.
Oh, shame.
Right? That's another thing,
not
too.
Not just for Spinderella.
Because, Like, we barely even, we get into the fact that, there was a Spinderella before her who did not last.
Right.
And the girl who plays the actual who plays the Spinderella that we all know and love, poor thing, she probably has 3 lines in the entire movie.
If I made a Salt and Pepper movie, it would actually be about Spinderella.
Right?
Yeah.
Come on. So, if you like Salt and Pepper, then go ahead and watch it, but don't expect to get a lot of questions answered or anything like that. And I also finally watched The Little Things, and I guess The Little Things is Blue Balls, because after watching that movie, I'm just like, oh, okay. So
yeah, I watched it too. It's okay.
Right. And I'm mad about it.
It seems like a big old waste of talent.
Yeah, it is.
And Sean mentioned in our group chat that it's a 30-year-old screenplay.
Right.
And when you said that, I was, oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
This feels like a 30-year-old movie.
Right.
I saw a little, more than a little, I saw at least 45 minutes of it at the drive-in waiting for something else for a second time. And the second time I'm around, I liked it a little bit more because I wasn't waiting for a better or more
story.
Right. Yeah, for a traditional ending. I don't think it's bad. I think it's barely good.
Mm-hmm.
If you really love, sad, dark detective thrillers.
Which I normally
do. I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
It's also strange to see Rami in that role. Like really? You're married with children? Just a cop. With so
stupidly adorable children.
Right. They're...
I feel like I'm a little biased because one of them looks a lot like my niece, but like every time those kids were on screen, I was like, I love you.
They were super adorable. But yeah. Like just keep him in weird roles. Like that's where he belongs. Like that's who we're calling on.
And Jared Leto is just trying so fucking hard and it's gross.
Dude. Like, at first, I was into it. I was like, yeah, like, I appreciate this. But then as the time goes on, it's like, okay, come on. I need you to dial it back just a little bit. Nobody is this weird. Come on.
Rami Malek, why are you looking up at the ceiling all the time? What's up there? Why are you constantly tilting your... It's like he's got something heavy. It's, you know when you're wearing a backpack and it pushes you forward a little bit? Like that in reverse. Like, he's just being compelled backwards.
It's the ancestors. He's looking up and he's waiting for their approval. That's what he's doing.
Well, it is entirely possible that one day we will speak of it again. It is the number one movie in America as we record this, so it is on the list. Congratulations. Not a big achievement right now.
Like, I hope you get that out of your system now, Denzel. Fine, you've got your seven. Let's move on.
Yes. Right.
I guess the biggest criticism you could level is there's this movie that is right up Camila's alley, and I think she's more enthusiastically endorsing the Salt and Pepper Lifetime movie than...
Yes,
right.
Yes, exactly. Watch Salt and Pepper.
Yeah.
Don't bother with Little Things. Or if you do watch Little Things, just know that... Lower your expectations about a couple notches.
My Robin? Recommendation is the documentary Showbiz Kids, which is on HBO Max. Mm. It's about child actors, and it's directed by Alex Winter, Bill S. Preston Esquire. And I mean, you know, it's not like groundbreaking as a documentary in any way, but it's just a really interesting subject. Like, what is it like to be a child actor? How does it mess you up? And how do you move on into adulthood? And he got some really great subjects. So he has Todd Bridges, Willis from Different Strokes is in there. And like, is a great example of someone who really struggled. Like, he was sexually assaulted as a child actor, and then he ended up having a drug problem. He was on trial for murder or attempted murder at some point. Has since then kind of sorted his life out. And
I thought Todd Bridges was dead.
He is, I believe, alive.
Oh.
Because two of the subjects of the film are died between filming and release.
Oh, damn.
He has somebody named Baby Peggy, who was like a silent movie actress, and she died at like 101 last year. And yeah, Todd Bridges is still with us.
Oh.
And according to this movie, doing okay. And then the other person is that Disney actor who died of a seizure a couple years ago.
Oh, that little kid.
So he's also one of the main subjects, and he's really interesting because he's like 19 when they filmed this. And so he's like, well, I've just ended that chapter of my life and time to move on. And he like seems to really have his head on his shoulders, and like I kept being like, why do I recognize him? I never watched any of those Disney shows. And then when they do at the end, like, he died, I was like, oh, I recognized him from the news.
Right.
And Mara Wilson and Evan Rachel Wood. The reason I watched it is because Evan Rachel Wood was in the news for naming Marilyn Manson as her abuser, and Mara Wilson, who I follow on Twitter, was like, Evan Rachel Wood is really good in this documentary that I'm in, Showbiz Kids. And so I put it on, and she really, really is. She's so insightful. Jada Pinkett Smith, who I did not realize was a child actor, is in there, and she has the perspective of having gone through it herself and now like kind of shepherding her own children through it. And Mila Jovovich, or however you properly pronounce her name, talks about her ridiculous... Her teenage years are just upsetting and weird, and she is so chill about it. She's like, yeah, these people rape me, no big deal. Yeah.
Well, I will check that out. You said it's on HBO Max.
Mm-hmm.
And also kind of the same, sorry, just real quick, in the same vein and genre, Jaleel White, Urkel, has a podcast called Ever After with Jaleel White, and he talks to a lot of child actors that he used to work with in the 90s and stuff, you know, as adults now. So it's a lot of that kind of thing, like telling stories about their lives as children in the industry.
Awesome.
I was super pissed at Marilyn Manson. Well, as we all should be, because it's one of those things where I was like, I was a legitimate fan. I've seen Marilyn Manson like 5 or 6 times and really enjoyed those concerts specifically. I don't know how much I listen to Marilyn Manson at home, but he's traditionally been great live. And so initially I had that like, God damn it. What this fucker? Why can't? And then that swiftly transitioned to, why did I think that this would never happen?
Exactly. With this guy? Like, exactly. That was like one of the first, anytime I ever saw him with anybody, this is not a surprise to me. Like, it's like, yeah, obviously it's terrible, and I hate the fact that she had to go through that and all the other women that he subjected to this, but it's like, I kind of figured like that was his shtick.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for, well, like, where's Rose McGowan on this? I'm surprised she hasn't come up to talk about it.
Trapped under something heavy.
Oh boy. I mean, good for Evan Rachel Wood for saying, you know, because he apparently had skated for quite a long time. Right. So, and it also ties into the RIP Dustin Diamond. That's a shame. Did I talk about Dustin Diamond on the podcast?
I don't know. What did you see? He was just at Steel City, like the last one before the world went to shit. Yeah.
So I think this can't be considered a humble brag, because literally every comedian in America has done a show with Dustin Diamond, myself included. And I did one terrible show with Dustin Diamond. It wasn't his fault. There were ancillary issues that prevented that from being good. But, you know, for all of his reputation, he was very nice, very friendly, professional. And about the only meaningful exchange I had with him is we were standing as the show was beginning, and the like hype up music at the beginning of the show was the Black Eyed Peas, Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night. And very earnestly, he turned to me and said, how many times have you been in a room like this hearing this song and thought, no, it's not gonna be a good night? I was like, yes.
You get me.
Very relatable. Well, this is a somber way to, and you can't handle the truth.
Woof. Also, RIP Cloris Leachman, Hal Holbrook. Bad week.
Yeah.
I missed a Royal Rumble for the first time since 2013. That's clearly the big tragedy here. Well, let's turn it around by this exciting movie draw. I like not having a veto. I mean, I'm going to take it if, you know, I hit it on bingo, but it's nice to go in and be like, hey, if this goes sideways, it's not on me. Well, the problem last week was, you know, we went straight to a sequel. We didn't want to do Hellboy because it's not always as fun to go straight to a sequel. Let's see how that goes this time, as we've landed on not 21, but 22 Jump Street.
All right.
Okay.
Sure, why the hell not? 21 Jump Street is really good.
Yeah.
One of those, like, pure joyous discoveries where you're like, they're remake Channing Tatum's in a 21 Jump Street movie, and then it was just so much fun. I think I liked the other one, but I truly don't remember.
Bingo spoiler.
I watched it on an airplane. It's from that era of movies where it's like, yep, I watched that on an airplane.
Yeah. You got a bingo spoiler. So
Mr. Tate's himself.
No, Jonah Hill. Of course, Mr. Tatum.
Hey, you can like who you like.
Yeah,
you know.
No, I just was surprised.
I think Channing Tatum is one of those people who you're not allowed to not be attracted to him, regardless of your sexual orientation. I don't care how straight you are. Like, look at him. Come
look at
on.
That strapping young man.
And he has the whole package.
He
right?
can like dance.
He can dance. He's funny. I don't know if he can sing, but let's pretend he can.
Mm-hmm. So, 22 Jump Street. Well, Jillian Bell is great in this movie, right?
I think so.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
And I mean, when we record, I do have a story about my sister and Peter Stormare.
Oh, I'm excited. Right. I'm writing it down so I don't forget.
I'm just got, again, The Town, Taken, Solo, A Star Wars Story, The Bone Collector. I'm just glad we're having fun. Yeah. Let's have some fun. It's cold, cold month.
Yeah.
Before we skip both an entire TV series and a film to get to 22 Jump Street, Pretty in Pink was released February 28th of 1986. What was the number one song in America?
Madonna?
Nope.
Janet Jackson?
Nope. I think we would classify this as one-hit wonder.
Wang Chung?
No, that's closer.
Kaga Ju Goo Goo.
You're in the category. The category is bands that you forget exist until you hear the song and then go, who does this? Oh, yeah, that's what we're looking for here. The song title has one word. The band's name has two words. But between those three words, there are only two different words.
The Human League. Yeah. Human by the Human League.
That's an answer that satisfies that clue, but it is still incorrect.
Okay.
That was a good one. That was a good guess. Three words total, and two of those words are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes. I have Oingo Boingo. What's the other?
That's almost what I said. I don't know how to otherwise. Additionally, the title of this song is one of those things where you're like, oh, that's what they say in that line? I had no idea that's what that line is.
Is it Rio Duran Duran?
No. If, just marching more and more towards saying it, more people probably think this song is called The Road That I Must Travel.
Road That I Must Travel.
Travel? I don't think I know this song. Is this a famous song?
Semi-famous. In a indie movie that I love, there's a discussion of this song where one of the characters mistakes the lyric in question for Carry a Laser. Amanda Peet thinks they're singing Carry a Laser in the movie The Way, Way Back, which is a different movie from The Way Back. This is the longest it's ever gone.
Yeah, I think I'm fully stumped on this one.
Carry a Laser.
It's not Carry a Laser, it's Kiri Ilazon. The name of the song is Kiri by Mr. Mister. Kiri Ilazon down the road that I must travel.
Oh. I know of Mr. Mister, but I would never have guessed that song. I don't know the name of that. Okay.
Yeah.
That's those are the lyrics to me.
I should make a playlist just of those songs, because there's a bunch of good songs from the 80s that are like Your Love by The Outfield. No one knows what I'm saying when I say Your Love by The Outfield. You have to go, Josie's on a vacation far away. That one.
Exactly.
That's a great song.
Yes. Voices Carry. I always thought they were saying This Is Scary.
Oh, and Abby Feuder, friend of the show.
Number